Okay, so let me start with introductions. Thanks everybody for coming. Before I introduce our speaker today, I'm told that I need to make this announcement that we have an event next on Wednesday, 25th of March. The governor of the Bank of Greece, Yannis Tournaras, is giving a public lecture in the evening at 6:30, and the tickets for that event go online are available from tomorrow. You can get a ticket from the LSE events website from tomorrow, for those interested. 25th of March is the public lecture. Now, our speaker today is Professor Vasiliki Skreta. I thought Dimitris would be here to listen to that, but one of the new big names in economics from the Greek academia, of the generation that really have established themselves internationally, and they give a new impetus to economics research in Greece. She's professor of economics at the University College London, and she worked before, she comes from the States, she did her PhD in economics at the University of Pittsburgh, and then moved on to UCLA, University of California, and the University of Minnesota, and New York University's Stern Business School of Business. She has published in some of the best economics journals, including the American Economic Review, Journal of Monetary Economics, if I'm not wrong, Journal of Economic Theory, Review of Economic Studies. She is at the editorial board of the Journal of European Economic Association and the Review of Economic Design. Her work is mainly on microeconomic theory, and she working mainly on mechanism design, as I'm sure you all understand what that is. But today she's going to be talking about a project she's been working on in relation to reforms in Greece to the Greek economy, and in particular the topic of privatizations. This is a project where Dimitris Vagianos was here briefly with some other colleagues in Greece. They're producing an edited volume looking at different sectors of the economy and the reforms there. And the part of this work is proudly supported by the Hellenic Observatory, I should say. Okay, with that introduction, Vasiliki, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. First of all, I would like to thank the LSE and the Hellenic Observatory for the support they have offered to this chapter and this book. And as Vasilis mentioned, my work is on mechanism design, which is a very abstract space of microtheory. So I'll be talking about something very pragmatic, which is designing actually, or thinking about how to design a privatization process. And I have to start by saying that talking about this is a great way to make enemies, because whatever you say, there's going to be some objection. So, and it's actually very hard to find, even though there's an extensive literature, both empirical and theoretical, you know, you can always raise objections. So I will try to give as best as I can, and my view of what privatizations can be and should be, and what are mistakes or what are good things that happen. So, one could argue that Greece's prosperity could depend largely on the privatization programs they have scheduled. And the reason is that the public sector in Greece is big, and I'm going to show you a graph to illustrate why it is big compared to other countries, and it is inefficient. So if you think about Trenosa, Olympic Airways, it costs millions to taxpayers to support these large corporations. At the same time, the country's debt is really big. So if you want to take new loans to fund investments, that's not possible because you already owe too much money. So private capital, ideas, and know-how could be helpful at this point. But privatizations have to be designed very carefully and carried out with great care. So why is that true? So privatization can be pivotal for prosperity because, as I said, they can generate funds, which are under the current scheme, the funds would go to for the loans, but now the government announced today that the funds are going to stay in Greece. Regardless of where the funds go, privatizations can bring investments if they are sold to good hands, and tax revenue, so that's good. And because they can bring investment and tax revenue, they can function as a vehicle towards growth and prosperity. So an example of that is Chile. So Chile privatized extensively during a Pinochet period, and some of the privatizations can be argued that they were not carried, you know, in the most transparent way. But despite, because the property rights were respected and other reforms accompanied privatizations, actually these privatizations were a vehicle for growth for Chile. On the other hand, a poorly designed privatization program can be a disaster for a country. So first of all, it can unjustifiably enrich few well-connected individuals. So what happened in Russia is that privatization led to these oligarchs. And according to some people, after Russia privatized, even life expectancy dropped. Because the economic, as a result of these privatizations, the economic conditions became so dire that even life expectancy dropped in a measurable way. Or another bad example is the privatization of telecoms in Mexico, which were sold to Carlos Slim. So Carlos Slim now and these oligarchs, they own soccer teams and they're among the richest people in the world, and there's not a really good reason that they're added value. They just got assets. So Carlos Slim got the telecoms via an LBO, so basically he paid for it with the future earnings of the company. And okay, you might argue, okay, these people became rich, but what's the problem? The problem is that such privatizations can also inhibit growth through high prices at essential services. So some argue that the fact that Carlos Slim got the telecoms and became a monopolist in Mexico, this has inhibited growth in Mexico because he has sustained high prices for telecommunication services. So now small businesses have to pay these high prices, and that's not good for growth. And in other cases, like in the case of privatization of the Stamangas shipyards in Greece, this privatization has brought production to a total standstill. So on one hand, you have Chile, for which a country where which privatization worked very well, and others have, and other examples where privatizations were very bad. So it's not an easy question to answer. Is it good and how to do it? In any case, Greece has committed to privatize as part of the bailouts. So even if we don't like it, or even if it's not a great idea, I don't know, maybe it's a great idea, we privatizations constitute a central reform in Greece's bailout. And actually, the Troika, or you know, the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the European Union, they have asked us to form a privatization agency, which is going to be independent of politicians. It is going to be manned by professionals, and the privatization agency of Greece was known until today as the Hellenic Republic Asset Management Fund, also known as TAIPED. Today, it has been renamed to the fund of the country's wealth or something like this. And the goal of this privatization program was initially to raise 50 billion, but this is a very ambitious goal because even if you calculate the total value of the Greek assets, one could argue that they could be less than 50 billion at this point. The current goal was to raise 11.1 billion until 2016. And whatever, 25 until 2020. In any case, since the bailout, we have raised, they have sold assets worth of 7.7 billion and they received 3.1 billion. And what is for sale is corporate assets, infrastructure, and real estate. So let me just first tell you why I said Greece's public sector is large. So this is from the OECD 2010. The blue is Greece and the rest is all OECD countries. And then you see the public ownership and involvement in business operations. So Greece is the top country according to these measures. And then you also see that in 2003, which is the triangle, some countries were higher than Greece, like Turkey here, but now Turkey is below Greece. And Greece is still has the highest public involvement and ownership. Now, I don't expect you to be able to read this, but I just put all the privatization, so once the slides go on the website, you can see This is the entire list of privatizations that Greece carried out before the crisis. So if you look, if you have like magic eyes, or if you look at the slides when I post them on the website, you will see that it's all sorts of things. It's Greece has already privatized utilities, parts of water supplies, has privatized telecommunication, OTE, a large part of OTE, Hellenic Petroleum. So it's also banks. A lot of banks were privatized during the that period. Many different assets. So they have raised about 33,700 million dollars from these sales, and this is a relatively modest privatization compared to other countries. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a nice graph to summarize it. But even though we privatized all this, compared to other countries, we didn't privatize as much. So what is now for sale? So at the beginning of the bailouts, a lot of the assets were land. So Elliniko as the most prominent, but you also have the Amphandou Beach in Rhodes, the Astir Hotel, and other buildings. The International Broadcasting Center, of course. And you have and other assets that are kind of unique, like thermal springs. It's a bunch of Xenia hotels. You see the beach, Xenia and Symphonia, these assets. Then you have infrastructure, Hellenic motorways, Egnatia Odos motorway. You have ports, you have Tenose, you have Athens International Airport, small ports and marinas, Athens water supply and sewage, Thessaloniki water supplies and sewage. As I already said, some of these companies is already in private hands, but small fractions. And then you also have corporate, Hellenic Petroleum, Larco, Hellenic Post. So, primarily, the portfolio is actually complicated because it's a lot of real estate which doesn't have clean titles, and a lot of corporate firms that need restructuring before they can be sold. So it's a complicated. This is not easy to do. So even though people, you know, make a lot of comments and say the privatization process in Greece has been slow, it is true that it's been below target, but it's not that nothing has been done. So I spoke to two former heads of Taipei and some of the other people in their boards about what they were doing. And I have to say that people that were manned by Taipei, they were serious business people. They were, at least in my view, in any case. I mean, there was a former head of Toyota Europe. So they were, you know, able people. And so they were, what they've done, they have completed 40 privatizations. But it's not only that. They have assessed 80,000 properties initially. And 3,000 properties have been pre-selected for development, and 1,000 transferred to the fund. So a lot of this is real estate that the country that the state owns. And the real estate in Greece is complicated because you can have a piece of land and then sub pieces of land owned by private individuals. And because the land registry is imperfect, it is very hard to have a very clear view of who owns what. And because of the portfolio is mostly real estate, then you can imagine how long it takes to prepare. And they also had to pass a number of regulatory. They had to raise a number of regulatory and technical barriers, and so to pass some laws to be able to sell a certain assets. And they also designed and implemented an online auction website where they sell medium and small real estate assets. So this is basically a website where you can just go and bid for a house or a piece of land or whatever. And this is from the latest report of the privatization agency. So as I said, the privatization agency, it was called until today the Hellenic Republic Asset Development Fund. But now I don't know the name, but in any case, the privatization agency said they've sold these things like You see here a concession of airports that is still has not gone through the parliament. The main things have been maybe the sale of Elinikon to Lambda Development at 950 million. You have Spectrum sold to telecommunication companies for 380 million in last October. You have the sale of OPAP to Emma Delta for 712 million. Despire, as the sale of Astir Palace, Golden Hall 81 million, and so this is basically all they've done. Again, when I post the slides online, you can take a look at all the entire sales. What they've raised so far is 7.7 billion, and they received 3.1 billion. So in the chapter, I will describe exactly some of the terms, because some of the terms are complicated. They're not just about a price. So for example, for the case of Elinikon, it's not just this amount that the state is going to get. They have promised to do certain types of investment, and there are certain earn-out clauses and more complicated provisions about each some of the sales. So what are my the goals this chapter, this talk, is first of all is to give you this account that I just gave you of what has happened before the crisis and what has happened since the crisis erupted, and to kind of highlight what are the challenges of privatizing during a crisis and what could be the advantages of privatizing in a crisis, and how to best design a privatization program in a crisis. So basically, what do we want to do? We want to maximize the value of the assets for sale during these difficult circumstances. How can we do this? And the essential thing, I mean, auction theories essentially, the essential thing we want to do is to have many buyers show up who want to pay a lot of money. So the idea is, what do we need to do as a country to induce people to come to these sales and want to pay a lot of money? So before I talk about design, I just want to give you the broad. Before I talk about design, one has to think about the objectives of a privatization program. So the OECD lists the following six as the main objectives of privatizations. The privatizations are good because they reduce deficits and debt. They attract investment. They improve productive performance if, of course, the acquirer is a good buyer. They introduce competition if you set it up right. They develop capital markets. You can argue Greece has a well-developed capital market, but for some countries this is a relevant goal. And then they reduce the state's involvement in the production process. So I want to say, first of all, that in ownership, whether the ownership is private or public, is not sufficient to reduce the state's involvement in the production process, because you can have a company owned by a private sector which survives because only of government contracts. So what happened in the case of Scaramanga is that they sold the shipyard to a private firm, but they said, look, I will sell you this at this price and I promise to give you this business over the future. But then they could not keep this promise. So now what happens is that the new owner is suing the Greek government. The employees do not have work. The shipyard is closed, basically. So it's not just you have to sell. It's not just privatization that has to take place. It has to take place in a way that the company is going to survive without government, without the state's involvement. And one could argue, why do we need to privatize? We can achieve the other goals by other means. We can, collect money by taxing. We can give better incentives to public firms to be more efficient. And ultimately, actually, whether privatization is a blessing or a curse is an empirical question. And as I said at the first slide, in some cases privatizations worked very well, in some cases they did not. But we can talk about what happens on average. So there is a big study by Magison and Enter that it's a survey of the entire empirical literature on privatizations. And they find that there's almost unanimous support that privatizations increase output efficiency, profitability, and capital investment. And most of the studies underscore the role of competition. So it's not just you need to privatize, you need to make sure that the market design post-privatization is either competitive or there is good regulatory framework. And so you need the competition the role of competition enhancing quality, efficiency, and low prices. Privatizations are good for capital market development. That is especially true for developing countries. For employment, it is not clear cut. So most people would have thought that privatizations lead to massive layoffs and less employment, but the answer is not clear. In some cases, yes. If you think about the ferrocarriles in Argentina, where there are thousands extra employees, yes, privatization in that case reduced employment, but in other cases, because business increased, they had to hire people. So it's not obvious. And social justice, so if you think about social justice, about the prices that poor people pay and so forth, again, it's not clear. In some situations, it has worsened income distributions. In other cases, it has not had an impact. And in some cases, actually, privatizations have been very good for poor people. For example, privatizations of water in Argentina have been associated with an increase in life expectancy, because more people had access to clean water. So it's not easy to say whether it's bad or good. In some cases it's good, in some cases it's bad. And fiscal objectives, that there is a study by Barr in 2000 that finds that privatization proceeds tend to be transferred to the budget and sales. So they have been linked to a positive improvement in them. But this depends on when you sell. So a report by Nira Consulting in 1996 examined 31 privatized infrastructure companies and found that the revenues from these sales positively contributed to the governmental finances. So this is basically a summary of the literature. So to come back, most people find, most studies show improvements in productivity and performance. It's good for fiscal objectives, privatizations are good. For employment, it's not clear. And now we go to other issues related to the background. How do you want to privatize? Do you want to do an auction? Do you want to do an initial public offering, negotiation, do a book building? Is there an effect of the identity of acquirers, foreign versus domestic, strategic or non-strategic, and so forth? So in some cases, some studies have shown that selling to foreign firms, it can be a good idea. For example, there are studies that looked at the privatizations of banks in Mexico, and they privatized to domestic firms, but the domestic firms did not improve the governance of the banks. So they sold to local bankers. The politicians needed a loan to run an election campaign. They would go to the local banker. The local banker would give them the loan. And at the end, the banking sector collapsed. So then they had to bail out the banks, and then they privatized, and they sold to, the second time they sold, a lot of the banks went to international hands, like Citibank, HSBC, and after the banks were acquired by international banks that were fulfilling criteria on when they were giving loans and so forth, then the performance of the banks improved. So it was not about whether the hands are in public hands or in private hands, it was about the governance of the banks. And in some cases, the literature says that, like, if you sell to foreign big corporations, the governance is better, and that's good. So it's not that the per se the identity of the acquirers matters, it's just governance matters, and sometimes better governance comes when big foreign corporations acquire the assets. Another issue with that has to be decided is, do you want to sell the entire asset or a fraction of it, or do you want to break it in pieces? And most evidence suggests that it's better to sell as one piece, because then, so if you start selling small pieces of a company but you don't sell the decision rights, that is not a very, that doesn't improve efficiency and profitability maybe as much as if the entire asset is sold to one company who is then going to manage it, who then has also the decision rights. And then the timing. So that's also an important issue of what assets do you sell first, and how do you sequence the sales? So in the case of Greece, we were just, you know, Greece was suggested you have to sell these assets, and there was no recommendation what do you sell first. But obviously, what do you sell first is the most attractive assets. What do you see is a low-hanging fruit. So you sell OPAP, that is a money-making machine essentially. You sell these real estate buildings that, you know, host ministries where basically there is a monthly rent coming in from the state. You sell Ellinikon, which is an extremely attractive asset. So obviously you sell these assets first, and then it takes time to sell the assets like Trenose and other companies that need to be restructured and so forth. All of these questions that I have here with question mark is not clear what the right answer is. And there is a comparative study in the QJE that compares privatizations, I think it's QJ or JP, I don't remember now the journal, but compares privatizations in Hungary, Romania, Russia, and the Ukraine. And all these countries were similar in some aspects of the privatization process, you cannot really pinpoint what made the process successful or not in terms of these dimensions I just told you. So it's not just the rules you write down, it's how you implement the rules, and that's all. Basically, the devil is in the details. That's what I think from reading a lot about privatizations. But despite from the fact that the devil is in the details, there are certain things that are true regardless. So successes have a transparent process. The process is well designed. There is commitment to the sale and to the reforms that will accompany the sale. So you don't sell today and say tomorrow I'm going to nationalize. And there is a thoughtful post-sale regulatory framework. Disasters occur usually because of there's lack of transparency, corruption, and favoritism. This is the case of Russia and Mexico. Corrupt implementation of the rules. And lack to account for post-sale excessive market power. So these are cases that have examples of that is the case of the water privatizations in Bogota, and California electricity had some problems. The privatization of the California electricity had some issues because of lack of foresight. So what are the challenges that are specific to Greece's program? Greece has to privatize at a situation where macroeconomic conditions are extremely weak. And not just in Greece, but globally. There are global budgetary problems surrounding Greece. You know, these are things that we cannot really do so much about. And I have put in bold and red things that maybe are more under control of Greece at the moment. So there's tax and legal framework uncertainty. So in Greece, the taxes, even real estate taxes change over every day, not every day, but very often. So if as you saw, a large fraction of the portfolio is real estate. So an investor does not really know the tax liability of the asset that he or she is buying. in the future. And that may, of course, discourages people from investing. And also the legal framework changes often. The fact that there is domestic political uncertainty, and whenever there is a change in government, we have changes in both bureaucrats and in institutions and so forth, that also doesn't help. And we still have, unfortunately, currency uncertainty. So all of this translates to worried investors. And worried investors so investors are worried in Greece, and this can be seen also by the low foreign direct investment that Greece has been receiving, not now, but even before the crisis. So the FDI in Greece was much lower compared to other countries like Portugal and Spain. I think it was about 1% of GDP, whereas I think in Portugal it's 2.5%. So that's a big difference. And as Panos Tsakloulou was mentioning here a few weeks ago, if you want to invest in Greece, well, what's better than investing in government bonds that will give you 17.5%? This is an amazing rate of return. So why do you have to deal with all this uncertainty when you can invest in something that is, yes, risky, but it has a big return? So on top of all these challenges, the stock market is greatly devalued. So now we are about 700 units, when before the crisis started, we were above 2,000 units. So this is a great devaluation. And also there is a real estate market collapse, and which is caused by the recession, of course, the erratic taxation. So all of these are the problems that we have to deal with. And other problems is lack of credibility. So until now, so reputation takes time to build. It takes time to build the reputation that, you know, we sold this asset to a private hands. We are not going to touch it. We're going to respect the new property rights. And this lack of credibility is compounded because in some countries they've been recently moving to renationalize. This happened in Argentina, where they renationalized the oil company, and then of course the Spanish firm that acquired the oil, they couldn't do anything. So this raises concern. There is also an excessive rent-seeking culture. So if you want to do business in Greece, it's difficult because of the known problems. I don't want to name them here. And some of the assets are natural monopolies. So privatizing natural monopolies takes a lot of good thought. So it takes it's imperative to design appropriate regulatory framework. As I said, especially electricity and water are especially tricky. And last but not least, there are important environmental issues. So natural beauty is maybe Greece's most unique asset. So where you sell a beach or a hotel, it can have a big impact on a unique part of the country. So the balance is very delicate. So you want to develop, but you don't want to overdevelop. So what are the advantages for Greece? Despite all of these challenges, so why should Greece privatize? So potentially the gains of privatization could be enormous, because a lot of the state-owned enterprises, the SOEs, SOE stands for state-owned enterprise, have a very weak performance. And the benefit of having a public asset go to private hands that can use it well has a good example of this, I think, is the privatization, is the concession of Piraeus Port to Costco. There is no T, there's just S and K, which improved the performance by 50% in just a few months. Another benefit is that there is a high level of politicization in Greece. So most public utilities and companies, the management changes with the governments. So that means that there is low institutional memory, and the government intervenes basically with companies. They dictate who they should hire, how they should pay them, and who is going to be the management team. And as a result, of course, there is a lack of professional management and know-how, and which leads in some cases to poor quality of service. ADAP, you cannot say water in Greece is bad, but in other cases, if you think about bus routes, sometimes you have to wait half an hour for the bus. That's poor quality. The good thing is that the fact that we are under this program, this adjustment program, and we are forced to make structural reforms, is as if we have a bit our hands tied. We are committed. Because we got the bailout, we committed to carry out the reforms. And the reforms that we committed to carry out, like reforming the tax code, reforming the labor markets, and the fact that Greece has a lot of attention now in the media, means that we can improve the value of these assets via implementing some of these reforms. And of course, we can learn from many. There are many countries privatized, and we can learn from their successes and failures. So we can actually draw some wisdom. And the last thing why I think it's good for Greece to privatize is because the most important, I think, reason is Greece needs investment. So the investments will bring new jobs. And as I said, the country owes already too much money to borrow more to do investment. So the private sector, by coming in and carrying investment, that could be very good for growth, as it happened in Costco. I mean, Costco, I think they committed to do about 400 million euros in investment once they got the port. So that's good for the economy. So now, I have how much more time?
Just over 10 minutes.
Okay. As I said, there are many decisions that one has to make when they're thinking about how to privatize. I already said most of these things. And I'm in auction theory, so I want to a little bit talk about auction design, literature has to teach us about selling. How do you make more money? So an influential paper by Bulo and Klemperer compares auctions with negotiations. And basically this paper establishes that under some conditions that auctions are always better than negotiations. So basically the value of attracting, and auctions are, what is the feature of auctions? There is competition among buyers. So if you are the government negotiating with one buyer, even the world's best negotiator cannot extract more money, cannot make that bidder pay more money compared to the money that the government can extract if a second bidder shows up. So competition is really key. You need to have serious bidders competing with each other. And that's the lesson from this paper. This paper, of course, makes a simplistic assumption that is actually costless to participate in these auctions. And that's not true if we're thinking about auctioning complicated assets like Trenose or other corporate assets. Due diligence takes time and it's very costly. So a follow-up paper by the same authors looks at this case where, you know, they assume that bidding at an auction is a costly proposition, and they ask which is better for the seller, auction or sequential search. So they show that sequential search, so basically you start to negotiate sequentially with potential buyers, and then if you don't reach an agreement, you give the information to a firm, to another buyer, and so forth. So you move in sequence. And they find that sequential search is more efficient in the sense that there is not a lot of waste in due diligence cost, but profits are lower. And the reason why profits are lower are because preemptive bids discourage entry. Think about DEPA and Gazprom. they made this big bid. This could have discouraged other bidders from bidding, and then at the end, they withdraw the bid. So this the sequential process and disclosure of bids can preempt entry. So auction literature actually tells you also what you disclose through the sale has to be thoughtfully designed. You cannot go and disclose, oh, DEPA came and made a bid 3 million or 3 billion. That could be good under some circumstances, but it could be bad in other circumstances. So in some circumstances, it's not good to disclose these bids because they inhibit entry. And they also find that auction is more conducive to entry and generates higher revenue, but it could be inefficient because there are all these costs. And I think the most interesting recent contribution of auction literature that is irrelevant for privatization is the following, because now we're thinking about selling an asset that requires some investment. And usually the assets that we are privatizing require some investment, and they also have a feature that generate exposed verifiable cash flows for the buyers. So this is not in the plain vanilla auction model that I talked about earlier. So in this more recent string of the literature, we are selling an asset, let's say an airport, that requires investment to be, you know, to be modernized. It's going to generate cash flows through the fees that airlines are going to pay to the airport. And what can we do? How can we make more money? And there's an influential paper by DeMarzo, Kremer, and Skripacz, and Skripacz, Dante Skripacz also overviews this literature, that analyzes auctions with contingent payments. So now the government is not just going to get the bid. The company is going to bid something, but then there's going to be contingent payments later coming. So the contingent payments can be in forms of equity, debt, call options, royalties, and so forth. So this is a good idea because now the government remains a residual claimant to the asset. And because the asset is managed by private hands, and because the private firm owns most of the asset, and they're just giving a fraction of it to the government, it's a good way to align incentives. So now the government has an incentive to sell it to a productive person or a firm because they know that they're going to be getting a fraction of that economic value that is going to be created. And they show, so this paper showed that the auctions with contingent payment in this environment are the best you can do. There are some caveats. There could be adverse selection when X is not constant, and moral hazard, because now you don't, if you start taking a fraction of what the firm is generating, they might not work as hard as if they are getting the 100%. It's not easy to design the securities sometimes, but in any case, in most cases, auctions with contingent payments would work well, and it's actually intuitive why they work well. So this is what the lessons from the auction literature are basically. Competition is good. Sequential search and preemptive bids can be risky because they can discourage entry, and that could lead to less revenue. Auctions with contingent payments usually work very well and much better than auctions with flat payments. Other things that the auction literature teaches us, is it better to sell the firm as a whole or as to break it into pieces? In some cases, breaking it into pieces can facilitate competition. But this depends, so there is no clear answer here. Whether you want to sell an open or a sealed bid auctions, depends on the environment. In some cases, using an open auction, like the U.S. government did for the FCC spectrum auctions, was a good idea. Because what they did is they probably you've heard about this. They auction it simultaneously via open auction, so everybody could see the bids of everyone. But this openness facilitated some kind of collusion, because they could signal through the bids, the zip codes, the codes that they wanted to get. Seal bid. So sometimes seal bid auctions could be attractive for this reason. Reserve prices are very important if there is low competition, because there is a risk that you might sell if there is just one or two bidders and they could collude. It's very important for the government to have a good reserve price. And 5 minutes, yes. And then in certain cases, like in the case of Greece, where we are forced to sell under these very difficult macroeconomic conditions, leasing could be better than selling. And that's also, you see, why the government is doing a lot of concessions. So the Port of Piraeus is a concession. The airports that the airports is a 40-year concession. So that's a good decision in my view. Why? Because they are selling these things not forever, for 40 years. 40 years is a long enough period for the firm who acquires to make it worthwhile for them to invest. Because if the concession is too short, then there is no incentive to invest if you're going to have it just for 10 years. So the concession has to be long enough to make it worthwhile for significant investment, but at the same time, it cannot be too long so that the government is not committed to a low price in eternity. So I'm happy with this decision of 40 years. I think that's a good number of years given the asset. And again, for the lotteries, it's a 12-year license. They did not sell it. So how do you want to raise more money from the sale? The value is endogenous. So, and acquirers have to incur costs to bid, because they have to do due diligence and so forth. So to increase the valuation and the price ultimately, a country has to reform tax codes, labor laws, and signal commitment to their reforms. They have to be law commitment. Then try to sell when the macroeconomic uncertainty is low, which is a no-brainer, but it's not possible in Greece. Eliminate a regulatory uncertainty and make the maximize commitment through the legal status of the sale. So basically, if a new government comes, it's not possible to revoke the sale through a new law. I mean, there has to be a legal framework where, you know, property rights have to be respected. Otherwise, nobody is going to want to pay anything for an asset that could be taken away. So to attract many buyers, we have to advertise a sale. There has to be a clear timeline and facilitate due diligence. And of course, we can strategize. So auction literature also teaches us that it's good to exploit market rivalries. So Germany, during the World Cup, they had specific slots in the stadium for beer. So if you are a beer manufacturer, you know that if you don't buy the slot, your competitor is going to buy. So it's not that you were just buying the slot to advertise your product, you were buying the slot to prevent your competitor from advertising in that slot. So that idea can be exploited to think, look, to tell an international company, oh look, if you buy the railway in Greece, if you buy, it's not only that you're going to have this asset, but if this firm buys it, they're going to have this, that's going to change your strategic position in some other market. So these things can be exploited. And now in terms of, I'm out of time, right?
2 minutes.
So in terms of, if you look at the privatization agency's website, at least they really understand, at least the statements, they try to be transparent and full accountability. There's lists of approvers and so forth. And so it's good, but so the way the privatization agency is set up, at least the rules look good to me. But there are other problems that are a bit deeper in Greece other than the privatization agency. And I think a deeper problem is, I think they have to make it, and some parties are, and they're moving towards this direction, is to make mandatory for political parties and politicians to fully disclose the financing sources and business involvements, because that's very important. And mandatory disclosure of a potential conflict of interest. I've heard through the grapevine cases where the same consulting firm was hired by bidders and by the agency, and close monitoring of the entire process. So Greece is a small country, and the circle of politician, media, and business people is very small. So you need outside people to evaluate what's going on, and especially by parts of the process that cannot be transparent. And one key part of the process that is not very transparent is bidder selection. So it's not clear how bidders are qualified. Obviously, not everybody can buy a big corporation and run it. But how do you qualify bidders? And that's a little bit of a mystery, because a lot of things can be massaged through this qualification process. I'm not saying it's happening, but I'm saying it's not clear. You don't really see from the press releases on the privatization agency what are the particular criteria they followed and which bidders they disqualified and why they disqualified them. So, as I said, the proposed reforms, you need more transparency, especially for the bidder qualification, and a better clean auction procedure. The timing has to be fixed, the reserve price has to be set, and they could also use this lesson from auction theory to make contingent payments. And they do that in some respect through these earn-out clauses. And you need more publicity. So this website where you can buy real estate, nobody knows it. Why don't they list the properties on professional real estate agents? Like now, if you go to righttomove.uk, you can find private individuals in Greece selling their properties on real estate agents in the UK. The Greek state can do the same thing. Why not post on intermediaries? These intermediaries are paid by transaction, so it's not going to cost a lot of money either. And if you also go to that website, it doesn't look as the professional intermediaries' websites look. It doesn't have as much information. And most people don't know it. And for companies that are in the stock market, you can also do a secondary market offering and make payments contingent on assets' future performance or index them on the stock price. So, for example, if you don't do a lot of these things, I think there is critics could have legitimate ammunition. So one potential critic could say, look, when you sold your pub, you sold it at 6.19 per share, and the day the sale closed was 9.13. And so when the sales were sold, when the company was sold, it was worth a billion, but Greece got only 652 plus 30 later. And you see that around the time that the sale closed, when the LBO closed, the share jumped. So this is when the company that was acquiring OPAP managed to secure a loan to buy the company through a leveraged buyout, and that increased the price dramatically after all this information was released from the company. So if the price that the government got was contingent a bit on the share price, they could have gotten some of this up potential. For those of you who are I'm out of time. Water has been a big, big bone of contention. So if you're interested, I included some case studies on water privatizations in different countries, which I think are interesting.
Okay, thank you, Vasiliki.
Thank you for your patience.
There's a sense of all this is immaterial in a way, because policy is changing kind of as we speak, so we don't know what of this are going to continue with a new form of type and all that. But at least we got very wealthy information about how we see privatization. So open to the floor for questions.
You didn't mention winners' remorse, which I think is possibly important as why some auctions are actually.
Yes,
I just wonder whether you had any comments about that. The other thing which I was actually more interested in was who were. were the purchasers of privatizations under what circumstances? I've done quite a lot of work in Latin America, but I've been looking at privatization in the context of social security privatization. So the assumption was that there were going to be pension funds which were buying up some of these assets which were being released. And therefore the privatization was tied to not just a privatization of state-owned property, but actually a restructuring of other parts of economies. Given that there is also much discussion from the Troika and from the European Commission in general about the nature of the social security system in Greece and the need to restructure this, was any of this privatization in the discussion being linked to social security reform, pension privatization, and assets which could be acquired by pension funds? And if so, what was the view that was taken about it?
So let me answer first the question about the winner's curse or bidder's remorse. The perspective I took when thinking about privatization is the state's and the country's well-being and not the bidder's well-being so much. So in some cases when there is a common value setup, obviously the bidder who gets it, who wins the auction, in a common value setup is when you're selling an asset that everybody values it at the same amount, more or less.
Heathrow Airport and Ferrovia's acquisition and what that did to Ferrovia, which had knock-on implications. I mean, it's not just, I mean, the bidder's remorse actually does have wider implications from the fact that the winning bidder has a bit less in his or her pocket than he or thought, because it actually inhibits him from doing certain things which have a knock-on for the wider community, including airport users and what did or did not happen.
That's true. In a lot of cases where bidders, so in the case of OPAP, for example, Emma Delta paid some of it directly, and a big fraction of it was paid through a loan they got. This asset doesn't require a lot of investment because it just brings money. Then in cases like Hellenicon, the bidders have not paid anything yet. And so I see what you're saying, but in a lot of the cases where they're selling assets that require investment, the payments are not happening immediately. They're happening over time, and that could be a solution.
And possibly the investment doesn't happen. This is the problem. I mean, this is exactly what we actually see, quite a lot of examples of the things actually getting overloaded with debt and actually being dragged down. I mean, I could mention Manchester United Football Club and one or two other things which get overloaded with debt. So, I mean, it depends on what we're talking about. I mean, this is not a trivial problem, and it does have substantial knock-ons. But I did, you know, I put that up in passing because my real interest was, as I say, whether this thing is tied to anything else.
It is tied to the whether you're using an open auction or sealed bidder.
I'm talking about social security.
Oh, the social security privatization is actually not tied. The privatization program in Greece is just about those assets, and there is a different.
But if you read anything about Chile and what happened there,
I know it's mostly
Chile, and not only Chile, but quite a lot of these Latin American countries. But also, if you talk about what is going on, I mean, I'm giving a talk next week about infrastructure as an asset class of pension funds. There is an enormous discussion about infrastructure privatization. Go to Australia, look at that, but also look at this country and look across various European countries where these things are intimately tied up. And I'm just interested that none of this came up then in the Greek case.
It hasn't come up, yes. Maybe they should have, maybe the Troika should have tied the privatization program with the reform of the with the pension reform. But they have not.
Have not.
I think.
Okay, Kevin.
Thank you for the presentation. Perhaps a comment and then a question. When you were outlining for us the advantages of privatization, so much seemed to rest on pretty strong assumptions of institutional capacity and government to do it. And it doesn't strike me that in the foreseeable future those conditions would necessarily exist in Greece. The current government has made a submission to the Eurozone in which they say that they would take some kind of cost-benefit analysis of whether future privatizations would be in the national interest. And I wonder from an academic point of view whether it is conceivable we could have a robust assessment of the costs and the benefits in the context of political uncertainty, institutional capacity, which has been historically lacking, and all of the other aspects. And could this question actually be answered in any robust academic fashion, that the benefits outweigh the costs, given what we know about the immediate political uncertainty and historic institutional incapacity to deliver sensible privatizations?
That's a very good question. The answer, I think, it's impossible to do that. It's impossible because it all depends on the assumptions you put down in the model you're going to use. So I could write down models that give you any answer depending on the discount factor you make, the assumption about investment, and so forth. So that's, I think, it's not...
So it reduces to a political gesture.
Exactly. It's just... And that's the point. I mean, that's also the point... That's also the problem with privatizations. I mean, there are a few examples where you can really say it's clear. I think in the case of the privatizations of Piraeus, most people would agree that it was a good thing. Nobody would argue in Greece, for example, nowadays... Do you prefer having OTE as a public firm, as it used to be, where you had to wait 5 months to get a phone line, or do you like it now, where you can pay a fraction of what you paid, and you can actually have a phone in your house within days? Nobody would disagree about this. So, but on the other hand, if you ask people, was it a good idea? I mean, then you can come up with examples where you can argue whether it was a good idea or not. But for the empirical studies that I mentioned, there are large empirical studies that show that privatizations are good, but if you are a critic, you could say there is sample selection, because the firms that are privatized are always the most attractive ones. So again, if you are a critic, you can find ways to say, look, I don't believe this study, because there's a selection issue, and the econometrics are not sophisticated enough to account for the selection issue, and I would say you're right. So scientifically, it's impossible to carry out the counterfactuals. Even if you're the most, if you have the data of all the data in the world, and you are the best econometrician. So that's the facts. But in some cases, you can really say it was a good thing. At least most people would agree it was a good thing. So.
Thank you.
My name is Yanis Maravidis, and I've been involved actually in some of these things, including when the privatization issue was set up. I was helping the government. I've been involved in some of the transactions you mentioned. I have a few, and we can discuss them later, but I have a few questions for you. It seems to me what's extremely important is to decide on the governance of whatever it is, the entity that's going to be managing this. And the governance, and indeed the overall strategy that it will have, will very much, it seems to me, determine how you're going to conduct this. I didn't hear very much you discussing this governance issue, because in a way, privatization or nationalization, to me, is in a way a false dichotomy. The question is, even from the perspective of the sovereign, how do you maximize your assets? How do you have a greater return yield on your investments, which effectively is a complement to your tax revenue? So that, to me, is an interesting thing to discuss, and so what sort of governance you might want to put in place in addition to what this entity already has, which would need to be complemented in ways that would deal with what was mentioned earlier. And so that to me is a sort of a first sort of important thing. I want also to challenge you a little bit on what you said about Port of Piraeus, in the sense that you say everybody sort of accepted it. You know, I recall very well that there were lots of people who didn't like it at all. After the event, lots of people accepted it, because it's, you know, people said, well, look, you know, how much money, you know, these guys are, you know, employment and, you know, happy faces, whatever. what the authority of Salonika, we were actually helping, my lawyer, we were helping the government with that, and it was abandoned. And yet, you know, I can tell you there were lots of very interesting public health considerations that had nothing to do with the immediate return yield that were never debated. Salonika faces an acute problem in treatment of sewage. I mean, acute. I mean, the borderline of, you know, sort of sickness. And yet, that was never discussed, and the difference the investment would have made. And so I was wondering again, by reference to this particular example, you know, how one would, in moments of crisis, in moments where there is absence of debt to finance all this, because as you said, the yield on the bonds is 17%, how much will people want to have as a yield, you know, for a riskier asset where you have political risk instead? So, you know, what do you choose to privatize, and what criteria do you follow? And again, that to me is a very interesting challenge. I'd like to hear more.
Yes, that's exactly. So it's not just about. That's true. So thank you very much for asking this question, because I talked about how you maximize, you know, the revenue or the sale, and that's not maybe the only goal. The goal maybe. Which the auction literature has not looked at is to maximize, the returns of the asset in the long run, or just revenue today plus what's coming in the future in terms of investment, tax earnings, and so forth. So that's the issue of how do you qualify bidders, and that's what the scoring auctions sometimes look at. They basically say. When you bid, you just not bid a monetary amount. You bid on a certain quality of service. You also include a quality of service in your bid, plus a promise of for investment. And then the government has to choose, depending on the priorities of the government, which are determined in a democracy by the voters and the preference of the voters, they choose whatever bid they think is more makes more sense. So it's not that you can say, for some cases, you just want to maximize monetary bids. But in other cases, in case of water and sewage, public health issues are critical. And the fact that you need clean water, that's I don't know what you can do in terms of, I think all of this is, the government has been aware of all of these things when they were qualifying the bidders, and that's why I think it's important to have transparency. Because the privatization agency, I think they had some guidelines whenever they were qualifying the bidders to get a specific asset, just for these reasons of governance.
Yeah.
I have a question on the Port of Thessaloniki, actually, specifically, because the second biggest port in Greece, as far as I know, in terms of container capacity, and it hasn't been privatized or released yet. So, I mean, taking into account competition, would you say it would be a good idea to lease it, to privatize it? And would it be a good idea to choose, again, a Chinese firm or perhaps another firm?
State owned. I mean, it's a bit like this reminds me
of. Bernard, when the second round starts again.
I think it's. You know, I'm not intimately familiar with the idiosyncrasies of the port of Thessaloniki, but selling it to a firm that is competent to carry out investments more than the guy, it has money to invest and has money to make the port more efficient is good, I think. And now, in terms of who to sell it to. This is a tricky question because there are synergies between different ports and different transportation modes. So the synergies meaning that the value of an asset depends on the portfolio of the acquirer. So for example, if the same company owns both ports, maybe it's more valuable, the port of Thessaloniki is more valuable to that company because they can actually use it to coordinate shipments in a better way than if a different firm acquires the port. But this all depends on the specifics of the potential bidders, but it definitely, as a private, if you're privatizing the port, you want to attract as many bidders as possible, because even if you ultimately end up selling to a Chinese firm, you want to make the Chinese firm or the German firm or I don't know, the Albanian firm, pay as much as possible. And the way you're going to make them pay a lot is when they are afraid that someone else is going to get it.
Others?
Can I ask something, a more general question? What are the limits of privatizations? I mean, it's something similar to settlements, and how do you choose what to privatize? Not just in a moment of crisis, but also in a moment of non-crisis. What are the limits of privatization? And based on what you said just before, can we only judge whether privatization, can we only evaluate after it has been done?
I think, yes, that's a very good question and a philosophical question. So you could, not philosophical, you know, there are many very important thinkers who think, Stiglitz is one of them, and who think that it actually doesn't matter who owns, they actually prove theorems that it doesn't matter who owns what, it matters the incentives and the governance of a firm. And there's also an influential book, org by Fishman and Miguel, which was also discussed in the New York Times recently, that it doesn't matter who actually owns it, matters the incentives and governance. So for some people, water has to be public. Water is essential for life, and it has to be public. So why? Water privatization is illegal in Holland. Water privatization is illegal, I think, in Bolivia. Water has been private in France since the 19th century. All water since 1853 is private in France. France has fine water. French people are all healthy and fine. So
that's why they sell bottled water.
They do sell bottled water, but
public lavatory.
But you know, but you see my point. And it's not Chile, for example. They went all way through. So they privatized all education. I don't think there is any country in the. I think they have privatized most of education. So now, instead of the government paying for public education, they give vouchers to people and say, look, instead of spending this million euros or this million whatever the currency on education, we're going to give you money, a check. And actually, they give you a bigger check the poorer you are. So now, if you're a poor person, you get this fat check and you can send your child to any school you like. And schools now compete for these checks.
Have you looked at Sweden?
No, I know Sweden is...
Have you looked at what PISA and have you looked at what the OECD has said about the privatization of education in Sweden?
I'm not saying that...
No, but it's important because you said, you know, kind of ultimately it is an empirical question. So
it is, but what I'm giving you an example where it worked well, as with water, I'm not saying that... Privatizing education is a. What I'm saying is that it. In some countries it works well. So water privatization in some Latin American countries was a disaster. Was a disaster, and the same thing. I mean, Sweden has the highest PISA scores, and they have an amazing.
They've been going down
because they're private. Yeah, but
yes, it's generally agreed that this is the case by most people who look at it. The Swedish education scores have been going down. And that a lot of this seems to be attributable to the opening of free schools, which actually makes you wonder why other governments are supposedly learning their lessons from Sweden. But this is pretty generally understood. I'm not being radical. I am a good neoliberal. But I.
No. What I'm trying to say is that it's very like in the, for example in the UK, in the United Kingdom was a pioneer in privatizing utilities. But for example in the UK, you are very proud of your national health system and they're very good public education, and you know other countries have a private healthcare. I mean I cannot tell you, you know, this good should be provided by the state and this good should be provided by the private sector. It depends on the governance. In some cases, if the governance is appropriate, an asset can be equally can be provided well by public or private hands. It depends on the regulatory framework. It depends on whether there's enough competition. It depends on whether there are institutions and rules for decent behavior. And now if you tell me what should happen in Greece, that's a difficult question, because Greece needs a reform. The institutional framework in Greece is not, should be improved tremendously before we can have, good governance and so forth. The political institutions, I mean, there are many things that have to happen in Greece at the same time. But that doesn't mean that if we privatize or if we don't privatize, we're going to be better off. If we don't improve the institutions and their reforms, the assets are not going to be productive regardless of who has them. That's, I think, ultimately the issue. Because suppose the state keeps all these assets now that are in the hands of the privatization agency, how are they going to invest on them? How are they going to manage them? How are they going to put them in use? These regional airports that operate 1 hour a day, what tax revenue do they generate? Maybe it's better to give them to a private firm, even for free, and generate tax revenue. I'm not saying that they should do this. I'm not saying that they should do this. I'm saying that it's difficult. And, there are concerns about the environment, about health, about market power. All of these are valid concerns. Governance?
No, but the governance, sorry, if you look at me, sorry. The governance, I was talking about the governance of the agency. Because the reason we have this thing...
Oh, the governance of the agency.
Yes.
Yes.
And how you do it. Because the reason we have it is very simple. At the peak of, the fiscal, the gap, the funding gap that we just had, the discussions were about the second package, etc., and it was before the PSI, all this. And people were discovering, Europeans were discovering Greece needed a lot more money. And Papandreou came out and, rather foolishly, in my view, said, "Oh, well, we are so wealthy, we have 50 billion of assets." In fact, Sournalis had preceded him as head of EUV, said they had 100 billion of assets. Now, and of course, if you're a European taxpayer, representing European taxpayers, you're going to say, "Well, give them to me. Great, put them on the table. You have, that reduces our program." That's how this was created. And that's why it was mandated to contribute everything to the to a specific purpose. Mm-hmm. And in came completely, surreal discussions where, people who, to whom I specifically asked, have you ever sold a house? And do you know how long it takes in a market where you can obtain a residential mortgage, trying to sell the gas in the next quarter for this price? And these were the sort of calculations they were making. It was bound to fail in the sense of achieving the 50 billion. There was no way it was going to achieve it. And I agree with you, the most difficult assets were left out. And there are lots of problems with the assets. But it has raised a very interesting question of what do you do with all of this long term? And hence the question, which, to me, very interestingly, this government is putting again, because they don't want it to be a bailiff. They don't want it to be a sales agent for immediate sale. They say we need to do something more long term. But therefore, it seems in the public debate, it is the question of governance and the question of strategy for these things is now immediately posed. That's why I think it's very crucial. I mean, no disrespect, but I think this is really what, you could very valuably contribute to this with all the work you've done.
Yeah, so that's, I want to say that Vasily said that, this is basically kind of moving sand because things are changing. I try to put things in this work that are, give a background. So the empirical findings are empirical findings. You can, argue about the empirics, but this is what their findings are. And the theory is there, and some of the ideas about transparency, about the disasters that happen through favoritism, these are lessons that are independent of whether the privatization agency is called IPED or Fund of Wealth, or if the the issue about governance that you're also bringing up is also very crucial. So, and one can argue that maybe it's good to do it slowly and privatize when the conditions are better. But this has a cost, because if you privatize later, these assets remain without investment for a longer time, and maybe you could earn some tax revenue instead
Which
of waiting.
Same with the forest, same,
I mean, that's, it all depends. It all depends at the end what happens, because some of the assets that Chile privatized, they were sold at fire prices. They were even sold at negative prices. And they ended up being contributing to the growth of the country.
Can I ask my question then? In relation to that, I mean, you know, one of the wars that we had during the disagreements about the privatization was about the Asimica, you know, the Apulishmet Asimica that we give away, you know,
the family's jewel for
yes,
to pay the grocer's bill.
There's also this question about, you know, water, natural monopolies, public goods, and things like that. So, from the literature, the look that you had at the Greek case and so forth, is there a sense that perhaps there should be a separation between, you know, this kind of, you know, the specific privatizations which are to generate revenues, they have the potential at least to immediately generate some revenues to pay back some of the debt. Some other privatizations that, as Varoufakis said, you can do it for 1 euro or whatever, which are about bringing in investment for upgrading infrastructure and hopefully increasing efficiency in the economy, and perhaps some other privatizations which are to give, you know, to give away loss-making activities. Is there a sense that had this been clearly separated as three different tasks under the same agency, maybe under different agencies, there would be more effectiveness in the whole process, and also, I think, legitimacy in the process? Other similar experiences from other places in that sense, separating the infrastructure upgrading versus the revenue generation, for example?
I'm not sure, because I think the privatization agencies they hire consulting firms and specialists to deal with each case separately. So it's not that they follow the same strategy for every asset. And so they take time to prepare the asset, and the asset preparation takes a lot of time. And depending on the asset, they follow different, I think they follow different strategies. So I don't think that's so important. What is important is to have competent people organize the process. And the people at least I spoke to, they were extremely successful and competent people, and they were doing it, I think, they didn't have a zero outside option. They left good jobs and good companies to do it. So they did it because they want to help their country. That's my sense. But then it's a bit frustrating, because if you look at what has happened to the agency, they have changed the heads on average every 6 months. So for various reasons. So then you wonder, why is this happening? And I don't know why is this happening. And the answer is, I don't know. And it is a bit worrying that it's happening, that it has happened. And now it's happening again. So now the new management has to, even to just to learn about all the things that are going on, it's going to take months. I mean, this is a lot. This is a complicated process. Again, selling a house takes time. Selling your house takes time. Selling these assets who you don't know the ownership title, that have debts, that have employees, labor union claims, and so forth. I mean, this is a complicated task. The fact that they have raised this money, I think it is a success. It cannot be viewed as a failure, especially given Greece's... now you can argue maybe they should not have sold it. That's a different question. That's a different question, whether you want to sell or not. But... Yeah, so I don't know. So I don't think so. The answer to your question is that I'm not sure if that would be better. I don't know. Actually, I don't know.
Okay, one last comment by Bernard, if you wish, because
I only wanted to. I mean, some of this with Piraeus Port and Costco reminded me of the most free market supposedly oriented UK government trying to get somebody to build its next nuclear power stations. So it goes along to the French nationalized electricity nuclear industry to provide the technology, and it goes to the People's Republic of China to provide the money. Getting Costco into Rancorta of Piraeus is, you know, sort of stopping the frying pan for the fire, it seems to me. I don't know. I can't quite understand why this one is elevated to such a wonderful example when all you've done is switched one state owner for another state owner, unless you somehow think that the Chinese state owners are jolly good state owners, which maybe they've got better capacity than the Greek ones, and I will pass that back to my colleague here.
I think they're better.
ask the Chileans who might have, as I said, thought that property rights were being respected as the privatization was going on under Pinochet, but I wonder what they thought about the human rights that were being protected at the same time. I think we cannot look at these things in isolation. That's been most of the discussion, most of the literature on Latin American reform and Latin American social security reform, particularly in the case of Chile. Happily ignores and doesn't discuss any of this. Actually, go and look at what Mrs. Bachelet did at the very end of her first term, and look at some of the issues which Mrs. Bachelet is looking at in her second term, including the education issue.
Any comment on the Chinese state under the place? It's not necessarily in Chile, but
I can only say that the Chinese government has more money than the Greek government. They actually have a lot more money, so maybe them owning the asset for the time being, it's a concession, they have more money to invest in, make it, and put it to better use for the time being. I mean, China and Greece are kind of the opposite. China has a lot of savings and they don't know what to do with their money, and Greece is indebted.
Actually, China is also running on extremely high levels of credit creation, public and private, which sounds makes it actually look a lot more like Greece than we maybe like to think. Maybe they're all going in the same direction. Probably to hell, probably a handcart.
They don't have the current account.
Well, if you ask most people in Greece now, do you prefer to live in China or in Greece at the moment?
Yeah.
I don't know what they will answer.
You can ask
Greece.
Well,
yes.
Greece probably. Still Greece. That's true.
Okay,
in
I think we should
case.
Stop the China-Greece comparison. It's not necessarily to have interest.
But thank you
thank
all
you.
For your comments.
Yeah, and thanks, Vasiliki, for the presentation.